And they asked me to give a little bit slightly more general talk so that we can discuss more what are actually the issues about practical QKD today and what are new future directions that we can go to make that a kind of more practical scheme. So beginning of the year, my group moved to Waterloo from the University of Erlangen. And I would like to point out that many of the things that we are mentioning here, of course, come from discussions in the community with many other people. There are a few things that I will be mentioning that have been done in collaboration, some results, and with a various number of collaborations that are listed over here. But first, to give you the rough structure, the first thing is just to remind us what the QKD was about and what it is not about. Then I will talk about various ways about how to improve QKD, and that comes in three parts. The first part is something about how to improve hardware. That means how can we talk about different, how can we design better experiments, experimental setups for QKD. Then the second part is to talk about software. How can we actually improve the performance of quantum key distribution just by doing kind of software of class communication protocols for QKD? How can we use these ideas to squeeze more key out of the same experiment? And then we actually talk about the last point, QKD. How can we get it out of the situation that you just talk about point-to-point connection? How can we meaningful talk about networks and what are issues that come in there? So the first thing, let's start, what is QKD about? Well, we know, of course, that it's something about two parties, Alice and Bob, and they want to communicate, and Eve sits there and can basically monitor all kind of signals that are exchanged by the people. And the idea is that Alice and Bob want to have some shared secret randomness that they can use as a key for secure communication, authentication, or whatever you need a secret key for. And of course, sender and receiver, they sit in their own little world, so they are quite isolated. Eve cannot intrude into their apparatus, whatever they are doing. Eve cannot intrude into their mind to read what they want to do, what they are thinking. There's some space region around sender and receiver that is isolated. And what they certainly have available in our scenario is that they have a classical channel, so they can exchange classical standard information. Yeah. Now, we know that in this kind of setting, we cannot really do key generation, at least not in information theoretical setting, and that means not in a setting like Renato has been talking about. Yeah. So there's no way for them to create key. Now, if we give them a little bit more, like something like some initial secret key, yeah, then you can ask the question, okay, once they start with some secret, maybe now they can do something. But again, the answer is no. Again, in that setting, you cannot generate information for a secure key. So the idea is now just to ask the question, okay, what else? What else do they need so that they finally can do something about that? Yeah? And the answer to that is just that we can do something in that scenario. Once we give to the two parties an additional resource, and that is the quantum channel, yeah, that they can now exchange signals that are inherently described by quantum mechanics and can be transported between Alice and Bob. Yeah? And over this quantum channel, then you can send non-orthogonal signal states that really cannot be described classically. Yeah, they have different properties. And then we can actually go towards quantum key distribution. In that scenario, actually, it turns out in quantum key distribution that this initial secret key that we're using over here, this resource here, that will be used in the end of the day only to make this classical channel and authenticate the classical channel. That's all that we need this classical secret key for, this initial secret key for. Yeah, so that's the only thing. Classical channel plus initial secret key, we can authenticate the channel. Okay, now, as we say, quantum key distribution can solve our problem of distributing key over here. Of course, you have to be careful again in all realization. Yeah, what is actually the model that underlies our security statement in the end of the day? And here I don't mean the exact meaning about what means information perfectly secure, like Renato has been talking about, but simply something very simple. Yeah, You do an apparatus, you send out some signals. So how sure are you that these signals indeed have the quantum mechanical description that you said you want to have for quantum key distribution? Yeah? How can we verify that one? Gregor Weiss has been talking about a little bit that in his presentation of experimental results. The problem is that sometimes there might be some information code that's built in timing or frequency of signals that you are maybe simply not aware of. Yeah. The same is true for the measurement description, right? So we have some device and we say it does this and this measurement. How sure are we that this thing is really doing this particular measurement? Yeah. Moreover, typically we write in QKD, we talk about qubits that we send from Alice to Bob and then there are measurements performed. In optical experiments, of course, we have always full optical modes available, right? And your detector does not look only at on one mode, but at many modes. And so really you have to work a little bit harder to get a security proof for a practical system and really to make sure that how this practical system really fits to a good model in a theory, say, of measurements. Yeah? The other thing is that at the beginning we said that the two sender and receiver stations, that they are isolated from the eavesdropper. So the eavesdropper cannot intrude. Yeah? That's, of course, very important because in physical apparatus for QKD, there are settings. Something sets which kind of signal should be used. So there's classic information available that fully describes which of the signal option has been chosen. And once an eavesdropper can read off that classical setting, then, of course, you're dead. Right? Nothing more that you can do about that in the end of the day. Now, that is, of course, something you have as well in the scenario of classical cryptography. You have side channels that might be read out from your devices. So you have to be careful how to prevent that. But, of course, in quantum key distribution, things, I think, really get a little bit different in nature again, because here you have a well-defined, clear optical path right into the heart of the apparatus. Yeah? So that is a little bit harder to predict, I think, than if you have just an electric interface to a device. Yeah. Even the electrical one is not completely clear what's going on, but having an optical path right to your classic information is certainly something harder. But still, in all this model, what we are not doing, we don't make any assumption about the power of an eavesdropper to manipulate and read off the signals as they pass between Alice and Bob in that. And so that is then what we refer to as unconditional security. So there is no assumption about computational power, about memory, or anything that goes on for an eavesdropper in here. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about obstacles in implementing quantum key distribution, yeah, and to use it. The first thing is just really how do we start quantum key distribution, right? How can we start? And the thing is, as I said, we start with initial secret key, and that one we just use to authenticate the classical channel. But one has to think about QKD as going in rounds. Yeah, that means there's one round, one long number of quantum mechanical signal exchange between Alice and Bob. They are measured. Then classical communication starts to talk about those data, and in the end of the day comes up with something that is presented as a candidate for a new secret key. Yeah? Long secret key, much longer than the initial secret key. And now what you need to do to use the classical shared key that you have initially shared just to authenticate all the public discussion that you have been doing leading up to that key. Yeah? Once you have that, then you have a new secret key. You can portion off a small part and use it for authentication into the next round. And for that to work, of course, you need composability. That's something that Renato has been talking about yesterday as well. Yeah. Now, but still, it's a question how to kickstart things. Right? And in that problem, right, there might be a little bit a chance or a bit of opportunity for us to do something about it. And that is that this initial key only needs to be used for the authentication of the initial first round. And once this authentication has been done and was successful, we can as well publish this initial shared secret key. So we don't need to keep it hidden a secret forever. It only basically needs to be secret until we use it first for authentication, and that's it. So the question is whether we can just use it, because we just need kind of short-term security for that initial secret key. Right? So that is the idea. And so why don't we use public key cryptography for it? Because, I mean, still, to break a public key cipher will take some time. Yeah, and if we are fast enough, can jump in before someone can break the the public key crypto, then we should be fine. In talking about that, one has to be aware that there are still some problems associated with that. That is, a public key, you first need to distribute. So the time you're taking is not just from the start of your experiment until using authentication, but it really starts from the time where the public key is distributed to send and receiver. That starts your clock. We have to be setting on which time scale you can break this public key thing. So I think there's really much more work to be done over here. The second problem, and that is a problem that we certainly will be addressing today more, is that the key rate is not as high as we would wish it to be. And high is, of course, always compared to the rate of classical communication channels, which typically go in the gigahertz or maybe even terahertz regime. Yeah, if you really think about big optical links, the classical communication rate that they can bring over there. Right. So there's something in progress, and the first thing is that new QKT protocols are proposed that can really be adapted to a very high clock rate. Yeah. Yesterday, Gregor has been saying something about some experiment which now comes with a clock rate of 10 gigahertz. And so certainly that is the trend of people working in that area. Secondly, one can maybe tweak the classic communication protocols, the software, to get more key out of the same data. Yeah. And the other thing is, of course, once I do QKD via an optical fiber, there are many wavelengths that I can use in that fiber. I might be able to do QKD in one fiber parallel and many, many different wavelengths, thereby multiply actually the key rate that I get out of that. Yeah. But it's that said, yeah, I mean, we'll certainly stay orders of magnitude below the classical capacity of the same fiber. Yeah, I mean, there will be for sure always a gap. The question is as well whether we can use QKD not, if we talk about secure communication, to use it not only in a kind of one-time pad setting, where we directly compare key rate to classic communication rate. So what is really about using this key to exchange, to change just the key for AES or other ciphers more frequently? So I think there we still want to learn a little bit more about what is the exact meaning of what we're doing here. Intuitive is clear, the more often I change the key, the better. Yeah, that's already clear. But it's a question of what are more or less intelligent ways about realizing this kind of felt advantage. Then the other thing is QKD today just goes point to point. And here's the question, can we do better? Because users typically don't need point to point connection. If you think about your telephone connection, if you had only point to point telephones, making telephones on your desk to all people you want to talk about, you would be not as happy. So it's a question whether we can do something about networks. Yeah. And indeed, I mean, we have in Europe one European network on a quantum key distribution that works exactly on this kind of question, right? Of course, for that nowadays with today's technology, we need something like a repeater station where you need to trust this repeater station that is handling the forward of your key. So you lose the unconditional security in that sense for the end users at the end of the day. But still, it has as well some advantages for overcoming distances, and we'll be talking about that later. And the next thing is cost, of course, right? You can say how much your system costs. It's always said QKD devices are too expensive. One thing is if you talk about the level of telecommunication network providers, the cost of QKD devices are not as horrible, right? So they're buying other devices of similar cost, yeah. But certainly as more companies work on that, the cost of fabrication will go down. So that sounds positive, but of course it will be never as cheap as public key cryptography, right? I mean, that's clear as well. It can be made cheaper, but not as that cheap as classical cryptography. That's clear. And QKD needs dedicated fiber. That's not really true. You can just use properly as technology develops. Just use some frequency band for QKD, and then this will work as well. So that are my obstacles, and what I in this talk today we're talking a little bit about two ways of improving hardware over here, and we'll talk a little bit about the topology over there. Yeah. Okay, let's start. Yep. Okay.
Just on the last one.
Yep.
You mentioned that in situation three, when you're using off-point connections, but the line is
not. Yeah.
You also mentioned that you're using unconditional
security. Oh, yeah, right. Same, yep. It probably didn't fit on the slide. No, but no, it's true. Yeah, I mean you lose the same thing. I think it's probably important just at least to have very well defined assumptions what you're talking about. Yeah, so that you really can say my assumption is, and then you have something, and everyone clearly understands what you're talking about, and I can judge whether this holds or does not hold. Yeah. And I think that is always something to be able to write down clearly. If this and this holds, then we are secure, and now it's up to you to judge. And of course, it's better if you can formulate in such a way that people can actually judge whether they believe that or not. Yeah. Okay, improving the hardware. So let's talk about a typical point-to-point link that we are seeing. Right? I mean, if you go out, buy one, you get some performance of this point-to-point link. And the way we want to look at the performance is just to look at the key rate over here, which in the end of the day should be really key rate per second, not per signal or time slot, yeah, but really how much can we get in a certain amount of time. And then over here we have distance in some units, and of course the distance always depends somehow on the channel transmittivity, the probability that the single photon actually makes it across the channel. Yeah. Okay, and now we'll just look at some schemes, and you see first, in principle, from your protocol, once you look at the security proof for those that you have, you get some kind of loss dependence on the key rate that you see, right? And the best loss dependence that we see is that the key rate over here scales just with the single photon transmittivity, yeah? And there are several schemes that achieve that. The first thing is just, yeah, use single photon QKD, yeah? Second, as we heard from Holcron yesterday, you can use decoy state, VQM pulse BB84. It does the job the same. It has the same scaling. Today, I will be talking about two other schemes, strong reference pulse schemes, distributed reference pulse schemes, that have the same kind of scaling. Okay, now we have to know something about the scaling. But of course, that is not really the rate in experiments that you get. Yeah? The first thing is you have detectors that have dark horns and imperfection of that type. Once you do that one, you will actually see that there is indeed a finite distance where just the rate cuts off, yeah, and that's it. And that is depends on the detector performance. But I would like to point out as well there's an influence on the way that you do classical error correction, how close you can be to the channel limit, where you can work. If you cannot really do error correction at the channel limit, then this will lead as well to these kinds of effects over here. I think that's very important to notice. Okay, good, but still, we get here this kind of performance over here. Well, again, not really. I cannot experimentally access all of that. There's something like detector saturation. Yeah, your typical single photon detector can count only a certain number of clicks in a time interval. That's it. Yeah, and that means this is the kind of maximum rate of your detector, and only after some distance, if the number of photons arriving into your detector go down, then you follow again this error behavior over there. Yeah? So that is a typical kind of curve that you will be seeing. Now the thing is here about the scale. So everything I've been saying, or most things I've been saying, didn't really refer to CVT per signal or per time. Right? One thing is, why can't we just run a system faster and faster? One thing is this detector saturation problem in here. But there's, well, we notice at some point we come in really in the problem of classical computation power. Yeah, we need auxiliary protocols like error correction and private amplification to be run at both ends. And they need computational power. Yeah, and if I do hear my signals faster and faster, then at some point I can't process my data real time anymore. And that's the essentially important point. I need to be able to process my data in real time. Yeah, and if you use really a kind of family of error correction codes that comes closer and closer to the channel limit, this computational power that you need really scales up. Right. Second thing, as I want to do my drive the clock rate of my system faster and faster, I just get a problem of synchronizing my data, my signals exactly. Yeah, because you need finer and finer time resolution on both sides. And that as well is a problem. Of course, it's a, you can say it's just a standard of the communication engineering problem, but it's a problem, right? And you see, actually, I think as well in the experiment that Gregor's been talking about yesterday was this 10 gigahertz clock rate. Well, they actually used, to my knowledge, just a local clock. So they send a receiver next to each other, and they just provide one local clock. In a way, this is cheating. That means this experiment, they could not perform at that clock rate if you would go over a real distance. Yeah. So that are the problems that we're seeing in limitation of point-to-point links. Now, let's see. What I want to talk about now is really one point about loss dependence in quantum key distribution. Because loss is really the main problem that we see in key rate in quantum key distribution as well. Yeah? So if you talk about the error model for the channel, yes, there are errors in there. That if I send polarization or what other signal, yes, polarization or the other degree of freedom will be disturbed. But the main effect is really photons get lost. Yeah, that's simply what we have. And that means if I say, for example, go in with some Poissonian photon number distribution, I go through a lossy line and it's described by a single photon transmittivity error. So that means really the mean photon number will scale down with this factor eta over here of arriving thickness. And now the question is usually is what could be behind that kind of loss? Yeah, because loss is eavesdropper playing with that. So Alcorn has been yesterday already explaining that one thing that can happen is a photon number splitting attack, which is the following that you have somehow your source, which has some vacuum signal, some single photon, some multiphoton signals, yeah? That on the other hand, your detector over here has a certain fraction of detected signals, and the other are non-detected signals, yeah? The photon number splitting just looked at each signal, look at the photon number, and then, well, just sort it into signals that are detected. Well, see, they get tiny and tiny. Is that really? No, this is probably a classical pointer. Let's use that one. So basically it says that a vacuum just always goes into no detected signals. Multiphotons, you can split one off. And so one photon will be detected by Bob, the other will be retained by an eavesdropper. And then eaves can just basically send the single photons either here or there just to match the number of detected signals over here. Right? Oh, yeah. Thanks. Okay. So that is basically what you can be doing here. And as you go through this kind of attack, yeah, you can just very easily calculate what is the key rate that you expect. And I said basically ignore errors. Errors don't really play a role. They are not the leading effect of that, so we ignore them completely. So the key rate will be basically all signals that make it to Bob minus those signals where one photon came off here to Eve. Yeah? And if you put in here Poissonian photon number distribution, then you can calculate what is the key rate over here. You can calculate what is actually the optimal choice of the mean photon number, and you end up with a key rate that scales quadratically with a single photon transmittivity. Right? Okay, so that is what Eve could do. Now, as a physicist, we say, well, I know what the lossy channel really does. Yeah? The physical model for a lossy channel is that you say, okay, there's a perfect channel, and there's a beam splitter in there that takes some photons out. This is a physical model. We know this fits basically for whatever signals you put in, it fits very, very well. Right? And if you do that one, then you can now get, if there are two photons coming in here, then with some probability they are split, that Eve gets one, Bob gets one, but with some probability either Eve gets both or Bob gets both. And so the key rate in the end of the day is just all signals that make it to Bob minus those fraction of signals where Bob and Eve, both of them, get a photon. You go again through these formulas, yeah, and you now find in that case the optimal photon number would be 1, and the key rate would scale proportional to eta. The thing is that in the standard VQA impulse DB84 protocol, we cannot distinguish those two situations from our experiment. Therefore, we have to go with that line and get the bad scaling. Right? And so now this is the question really, how can we improve this kind of performance? Yeah. So here we have our two ways. So beam splitting attack can be here again symbolized like the photon number splitting attack. Important is now here that here you have a wave channel from the multiphoton into the non-detected signals. And that means here the weight about these processes for single photons and this process for multiphotons, what is detected, what is not detected, just changes. And what we can do now to improve the scaling, the first thing is to use single photons, which is technologically very challenging. Second, we can just test the channel better, and that means we can just get more information, what are the probabilities about this or that process to happen, or better, this and that process to happen. And this idea, just to test your channel better, to know what happens to your different photon numbers, that is exactly the decoy state protocol, what Holcron talked about yesterday. And if you do it well enough, test it well enough, you come closer and closer to this kind of attack. And as with that is where you come to the scaling of key rate proportional to transmittivity. What I will be talking about today are two other schemes that use a different technology. And what they are doing is just they look at this process over here. In order for the photon number splitting attack to be possible, it's not enough just to split one photon off from any multiphoton pulse. Okay, that gives you information. The problem is, this way you would get way too many signals arriving at Bob's place. So Eve must be able to get some of the signals here from the single photon signals to suppress them. So the total number of expected signals indeed comes out again as before. Yeah. So you need to be able to block signals. In standard BB84, that's not a problem. Just don't send anything to Bob. It doesn't look odd to Bob because, after all, there is loss in the channel, so some of the signals don't make it over there. Fine, yeah? In a way, what we have here is that you have a kind of neutral signal that you can send over there, yeah? So a neutral signal, and that is probably something that we want to avoid. And the first scheme, actually, that was built as Splintism is the, from 1992. It's a very old protocol, yeah? It's from Bennett. And really, the idea is just to find a protocol where Eve cannot block signals. Yeah? And the signal states what you use is just you use two optical modes, and in each of them you put a signal. It's a coherent state. Think about it just like a laser beam out of that. Yeah? And there's a relative phase between those two things, and that is exactly your information that you want to read out. Yeah? Then these signals go here through Eve's domain and come to the detector. And now you have here this strong pulse, here the weak pulse. What you do over here is just from that strong pulse, couple out a weak pulse and bring that into interference with the other weak pulse that comes from here. Yeah? Depending on the relative phase over here, the pulse will end up here or there. Yeah? And with that, you can read out the information about your signals. Yeah? And actually, if you would look only at those part over here, that would be very, very close to the standard BB84 protocol. But there's one different thing. Here the strong pulse passes, most of it passes through that beam splitter over here and is detected by a photon counter that can really measure the strength of the signal. Not only is there a photon in there at all, but just really measure the strength of that signal. Yeah? And as you measure the strength of the signal, you can be sure that there was a big pulse. Yeah? And that helps us now because there's no quantum optical signal I can put into these two modes that gives me, shows here the signal, hey, there was a big pulse, and that for sure did not give any click down there. Because that would be the neutral signal that you're looking for. Yeah? In experiment, you always see the big pulse over here, and there's no signal you can put in that gives a big pulse detected here and nothing down here. Why is that? Well, if there's a big pulse over here, then it was for sure as well some amplitude split off in the beam splitter entering down here. Whenever some amplitude goes down here, there is some probability we get as well a click. You know? And that means for sure that there will be something happening, typically an error. Yeah? So that is the basic idea of a strong reference pulse scheme. Yeah? Make sure there's no signal that Eve can suppress signals. In those schemes, something like photon number splitting, but taking learning something about the signal still works the same as before, with the same efficiency. So the security is very analog to standard BB84 with weaker impulses. The only difference is you cannot block signals. Yeah, and so their security proofs for those things have been done, and they confirm the kind of scaling that we've seen, that I've promised to you before. There's one problem, it has not been implemented. Yeah? Why hasn't it been implemented? There's a problem that you have to send a strong pulse through your optical channel. And in optical channel, then this pulse will lose some of its energy. It will be scattered backwards. Then it will be scattered forwards again. That this pulse smears out. Yeah? And that typically it smears out as well into the domain where your weak pulse is. Right? And that means basically this pulse over here will create errors due to the physics of the optical channel that you're using. Yeah? But I think people now start to really seriously work to whether we can get it to work nevertheless. There's one scheme that avoids that a little bit, and that are new type of schemes that are coming out that are distributed phase reference schemes, as I call them. Again, the same thing, no neutral signal, and just avoids the problem of the strong reference pulse. What they are using is just to send weak coherent pulses one after the other, and the information just sits in the phase. So each signal over here is a coherent state with the phase plus or minus alpha, and the information that you want to read off is the relative phase, relative sign between two subsequent pulses over here. Yeah. So they are non-orthogonal signal states. Good, we need that for QKD. And we can now do over here a measurement that is a non-trivial measurement that again allows us to do QKD with that in the end. So what you are doing is that the receiver gets this pulse, sends it through some interferometer, and you get interference. Yeah? You get basically here 50-50 beams which are in each of them basically the same kind of pulse come in with just half the intensity, interfering with that pulse train that goes along that long path over here. Yeah? So it means you have two contributions that interfere over here. So in the lower arm, you have then the interference with the plus sign. And if you look at these middle three regions over here, you will see that interference leads to that there's nothing in the first two time slot and a coherent pulse in the third one. In the upper arm, you get the interference with the minus sign. That means now you get your constructive interference in the first two time slots and nothing in the third slot. So you can just now look here at those detectors, and you can indeed just read off the relative phase between subsequent pulses. Yeah? So that is basically how this system is designed. We don't have a full security proof for that. We have something like individual attack on that. Yeah? We know something about ultimate limitations, how things behave and scale as errors and loss are introduced in the channel. But from the theory part, it's really we really have to work about new approaches, how to work on the security on those systems. And yeah, and there's another scheme from the Geneva group, the Coherent One-Way group, which uses a different signal structure, which is not equivalent to this one. And so that makes it interesting. One can really compare these two schemes. Okay, that was about hardware. Yeah. So what can experimentalists do better in hardware protocols. Now the second thing is just how about software, right? And by talking about software, we should be clear again about how do we do QKD, right? So the first thing is that you have a physical apparatus, yeah? And it just sends signals from Alice to Bob, and Bob makes measurement, yeah? And so that means on both ends, in the end of the day, we just have data. Yeah, I know which signal I sent, I know what was the measurement result of what I got, yeah. And so that are just correlations between Alice and Bob. And these correlations, of course, my data might be correlated as well with an eavesdropper, yeah. I don't know, yeah. That might happen. And that means we are in a way, in a situation analogous to just classic information theoretic key establishment, yeah. There you start with your three parties, and you just start, let's assume that these three parties share classical data that are correlated with the known three-party correlation function. Once you have that one, yeah, once I know what are these joint correlations, I can start to do secret communication, yeah, like Sisson Kerner has been doing, just by giving something about the key rate just as a function of the kind of mutual information, pairwise mutual information over here. Yeah, I can... Once this rate over here is non-zero, I can do secret communication from Alice to Bob, and I can do this just in one-way communication fashion. Yeah. Now, we are in the physical world, yeah, and so that means, as Renato said as well, Eve is not necessarily classical. Yeah, Eve indeed has a quantum signal over here, but the situation that we're actually having, Alice and Bob can just stare at their data that they're having. Yeah, what signal did they send, what measurement has been performed, and from that one they can draw something and say, okay, this states these data were drawn in the end of the day from a quantum mechanical state shared between them. Right? And once I know something about the state from which I drew my correlations, I know, thanks to quantum mechanics, something as well about restriction, how a third party could be possibly correlated with my data, correlated in the quantum mechanical sense in terms of the density matrix. Right? Yep? I always assume the worst on the east side. From here, well, I don't need necessarily entanglement in this relation if you think about bound entangled states. But I still don't quite understand. Because, I mean, from here, you just basically say, let's say you have a thermographic protocol and S and Bob know exactly rho AB. Yeah, then you just think Eve has a purification. And indeed, you can show that in these protocols that we are talking about, Eve indeed could get the purification of that state. And that means Eve would have rho ABE. So it's important as well, you can show that basically this works, that Eve holds a purification of the state shared by Alice and Bob, that Eve indeed can obtain it by the way she interacts with the signal. That's possible to do. Yeah? As a starting point over here. Okay, now once we have correlations, once we have the data over here, then now we can basically start to talk about those data to make a secret key out of it, yeah? And so that is something like a BB84, you would announce your data, yeah? You have to do classical error correction, because Alice and Bob, in the end of the day, at least should share the same key, yeah? And the initial data are not completely correlated. And you do privacy amplification so that you end up, indeed, now with a secret key, so Alice and Bob are no longer correlated with Eve, yeah, or Eve is no longer correlated with Alice and Bob. So that means we really have here the interplay that physics basically gives you correlated data with a promise, which replaces the assumption about the three-party correlations. Yeah, here you can just do this promise by looking at your own data. That is a big difference between quantum key distribution and that classical situations. Yeah, we don't have to assume three-party correlations. We can just measure things and then infer from that something else, three-party correlations, yeah? And then basically from there you can take that data and just basically finish it off to make a secret key out of that. Yeah? And questions that come up, of course, is something about what is the optimal way to extract key out of the given data and what are useful correlations. And I mean, before that, quite often we thought there must be something like free entanglement maybe in this correlation in a way. But there has been recent work as well that you can get from bound entangled state some secret key. But okay, I just want to give one simple example that shows that indeed it matters how we talk about our data and that there is the chance to do something. And that is this SARC protocol that has been developed in Geneva. Just think about, we do a BB84 setup, but we always send two photons. Yeah? And always each just grabs one photon and sends one off to Bob. Yeah? In that situation, can we do quantum key distribution? Of course, well, if you follow the BB84 protocol, of course not, yeah? Because in the BB84 protocol, then Alice and Bob would announce the basis of the signal, yeah? And in that case, just Eve can just measure later on in the same basis and get the complete information. So you are dead, yeah? So what they thought about is, let's not announce the basis, but just make up four different sets and then just say, give away one of the sets that you know your signal was in. So Alice would say, well, for example, my signal was in that set. Yeah? That's the basic idea. Yeah? Let's see how it works. Yeah? Eve still takes one photon off. Now, if she hears, well, I was in that set, there are two non-orthogonal states in her hand she has to discriminate between. Yeah? And so she cannot do that one without error. Yeah? So that means she does not get full information as she would get in the BB84 protocol. Still, we have to be careful. Bob should, on the other hand, in the end of the day, be able to get the key as well. Right? It's not enough to say Eve doesn't know anything. If Bob doesn't know anything as well, we haven't done anything really. So, and the situation here is now, so in some cases, Bob can identify the signal without error. For example, if Bob measured this kind of measurement and got that result, and then hears from Alice this type of announcement, then he can say, well, this signal could not, never come from that state, so it must have been that state, so he can identify the state. And then he can tell Alice, hey, this time slot we keep. If you come up with a signal where you can't say what was the signal, so you just say, forget about it. That's the power Alice and Bob can talk to each other and say which signals to keep and which one to forget. Yeah. And if you talk about that one, you actually can show that in that situation you can do a quantum key distribution, despite the fact that you use multiphoton effects. And so it's very important how we talk about our data and how to improve maybe our protocols to extract more of that. And so for that one, let's go back again to a kind of diagram as I showed you before. Secret key rate versus distance. So we have some of the part where we have indeed security proofs for certain key rates. Yeah? Actually, one can show that there's typically some maximum distance where you can show that the correlation that you obtained over here cannot lead to a secret key anymore. Yeah? And you can talk as well about some upper bound, how much key secret key you could possibly get from your correlations. And so now the SARC protocol gives some improvement down here. And so we now really have to see basically how much of this part of regime of hope can we actually turn into secret key and which one we can't. Yeah? Basically, this line might have to go down. I guess that's one important question that we are addressing in the moment. Because all those lines depend on technology today. That is something we have to be aware of. Yeah? And for kind of upper bounds over here, you can see this paper that's appeared recently on QuantPH. I think it's a good source for that. What we have been doing in Waterloo now is to find some upper bounds that can be evaluated easier for real experimental schemes, where the problem, the issue is about evaluating in an easier way, not to be tighter, not to be tight like the results in this paper are. Yeah? Okay, very quickly, last part, networks. Yeah, we want to go beyond point-to-point connection. In SQL, you see we work indeed on a whole way of having many nodes sitting over here and end users connected to these hubs over here, and they can be connected to each other. And the idea is that you can get now between many users, like in a telephone service, basically, secret key connections. But on the physical level, plane in the end of the day, there you have just point-to-point connections. These point-to-connections just end in hubs, and so these hubs have to be trusted. There's basically classical information transfer coming basically in free text over there. Yeah? And from that one, you build a whole network over here. The nice thing is that you can, of course, now think, okay, now I have to trust each repeater station, and if I crack one of them, I get all the secrets. Well, you can talk to Louis about it, because there's, of course, ways that you can connect this with classical techniques of secret sharing to secure these networks. So that means that it's not enough to attack one station, you would have to attack several stations in order to kill the application. And one question is, I think this network idea is very important, but there's as well one thing which for experimentalists as well becomes important. Because they, in the end of the day, here in my picture, would only provide point-to-point connections. So why are they interested whether we make a network out of that or not? Well, the thing is, once we would have a network, yeah, so there would be all these little gray points that would be we, the end users, we would be connected to a hub, and the hub is then connected in the backbone network over here. Yeah. And the question is, what is a good kind of architecture? Basically, how do we build up these kind of networks? But for the experimentalists, important would be what would be good cell dimension, all that. That means what are the point-to-point links we are going after in the end of the day. And for that one, do a very simple, extremely simple, of course, ridiculous toy model, which nevertheless teaches us something. And that is just, let's assume we have two users. They are separated by a distance, capital D, and want to get a key rate, G, exchanged between them. Well, the distance is much further than any of the QKD devices that we have today could be doing. So they build repeater stations. All of them are by a small distance shared, yeah? And now we know each link itself has a characteristic, how much key it can provide over a given distance. Yeah? And we want to know how should we choose that distance over here. Right? Now, the thing is just the total cost to go from here to there to provide this rate over that distance. Yeah, it's just the cost of each individual link, well, by the number of links that you have. So how many links do you have? Of course, well, it's just a question. How many hops do you have? D over D. And basically, how many channels have you do in parallel to get this rate G over here? That is G divided by the individual link rate. Yeah, so that's the cost. And now you do cost optimization. Yeah, so you put in basically what is your loss performance over here. That is just key rate proportional transmittivity. Yeah. And once now, and then you find an optimal distance in terms of the loss coefficient of your optical fiber. You put in this number, you get out 17.5 kilometers. So it's 17.5 kilometers, it's not 200 or 300 kilometers, it's a rather short distance. Yeah. If you go and look, where is this distance sitting in this type of diagram over here? Yeah, then we find the optimization point typically sits over here. That means we have to be doing the optimization with that curve. We can't really get it because there is detector saturation kicking in before. So that means the optimal working point in that case is shifted to that point over here. That means that is suboptimal. We really should be working here. So that tells us something for incremental setting, really. Basically, what I have to work on is very much really detectors, yeah, to get so that I can get the repetition rate of my device up. So I think that is a very important thing, and we have to be careful as well because there is always a tendency to say we should go for further and further and further distances. Once we go to a network model, then for the point-to-point link, it's not the distance really that we want to optimize. We really want to optimize basically the cost of service for that. Yeah, and for that one, basically the challenge for your point-to-point link might be completely different than trying to go for further and further for the longest distances. Okay, with that one, I come to my conclusions. First, of course, QKD doesn't do miracles, yeah, but it's certainly a stepping stone in bringing new applications to quantum communication, yeah. And the last important thing is it's doing something that you classically can't do, yeah. So now you have to see can you make something out of this initial advantage or not, yeah. Important is as well that of course, the QKD devices. Really, you have to be careful about the engineering to match the device and security proof. And so that is very, it's usually, one has to be careful. Whenever in a talk you see somewhere we get this and this key rate out of our device, I mean, at least you should ask, okay, what is the security proof behind it? Yeah, what do you really mean? Which proof did you use? What assumption does the proof use? Yeah, because you can get widely different rates in the literature today. Yeah. Important thing for us is really that we really need to look for schemes that are good in scaling and that allow a high repetition rate, because in the end of the day what counts is just secret keys per time slot, per time, not per time slot. Yeah. Interesting direction as well for us, I think, is to work more not only on the experimental hardware, but as well to talk about the software. How can we exploit correlations better? Yeah. To make more secret key out of a given experiment. Yeah? And then for the future, I think that maybe sometimes a good idea to look really far ahead and to say, well, assume everyone really would want to use secret keys like QKD. What would the network need to look like so it could satisfy that demand? What would be intelligent solutions to do that? And that gives us very feedback again for experimentalists to see how to optimize their point-to-point connections. Okay, that's all from each.